Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
I was thinking maybe we should start this by me doing an a cappella version of A Moment Like This from American Idol. Some people wait a lifetime for a moment like this. This is my moment in the sun.
Okay, Patrick, we are in a new recording location.
Yes, we are.
So this is exciting.
The district.
Oh, wait. Should we do the video?
Oh,
we should do the video for
sure.
The patron. Are you okay with that?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Let me get that started. You explain where we are.
Yeah, we are down in the basement of Hunter Bennett. Hunter, thank you so much for having us down here, man.
Hey, thanks for coming. Anytime I don't have to drive to Virginia, it's a great day.
We drove in to be with Hunter because we're going to be talking about hardcore all this week, and I'm really excited about this, Jim. It's going to be really fun, I think.
Yep.
There's a lot that resonates with you and I.
So, okay. So, let me explain. Let's introduce ourselves, because we always forget that. So, the show you're listening to is called Rockin' the Suburbs, although we are in the district.
That's right.
Today. Mm-hmm. But I think this will still show up on everyone's feed.
I think so.
It's just that today you're keeping it a little bit realer than you do normally.
Yes, that's right.
You had to endure the suburbs ribbing.
Yeah. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us is
Hunter Bennett.
Hunter. And Hunter has been on the show before.
Yes, he has.
He came over to my house in the suburbs,
yep,
and played bass with the band Dot Dash in the family room.
That was such a fun night. It really was.
That really was.
Yeah.
It was worth driving all the way to Virginia.
That's right.
That's all the way out to Virginia. And also an author, as we talked about in that week of podcast. The Prodigal Rogerson is his book. So definitely pick that up.
So that relates to this. So
absolutely.
Anyway, so I saw Hunter again recently when you guys opened for...
The Minus Five, I think.
The Minus Five, that's right.
Uh-huh.
And then again...
Vibrators?
The Vibrators,
yes.
That was it. That's where we had a chance to really talk with the Vibrators. Yeah, the Minus Five had the great story about how you supplied the bass to Mike Mills.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, something you dream would happen when you're like 8 years old, but would never actually happen. But sure enough, Mike Mills broke his bass and they were like, could someone from the opening band lend us a bass? And I was like, why, yes, I could.
Sure.
And then he was actually mildly impressed when I told him that the bass had belonged to Tom Peterson. He was like, really?
Yeah.
And then I told Peter Buck, and he was much less impressed.
Everybody has one of those, buddy.
That's funny. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that was great. Yeah, the Minus Five. And then again, you guys opened for the Vibrators. And that was where we had a chance to talk for a little while at that show. And coincidentally, that was right around the time that we were doing the Replacements stuff with the big rankings and the article and all that kind of stuff. And I had asked Hunter if maybe he wanted to contribute to the article, being a published author. That might be a good thing.
It would help our SEO.
And what he said to me was when he saw that many of the songs had already been taken, and then he said, you know, I didn't really listen to Replacements a lot back in the 80s because I was into hardcore.
Yeah.
That was my thing. I would listen to the hardcore. So I was like, oh, there you go. Like, that would be a good week of episodes to do. Let's talk about hardcore. I know it's a form of music that you're really into as well.
Absolutely.
But I was thinking, why not get the guy who was so into it that he basically just shut out everything else?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, from the time I discovered hardcore, which was in March of 1983, until probably 1992, it's pretty much all I listened to, which made the 90s really cool because I could then go back and discover all the stuff that I missed at the time. But I mean, I was certainly aware of the Replacements, but I was always disappointed in them because they weren't really a hardcore band. And even on like Stink, it seemed kind of like they were just pretending to be a hardcore band, which now I love those records. And I guess I'm, you know, maybe retroactively disappointed in the teenage version of myself. But still, I mean, there's so much great hardcore and, you know, I don't think I'd really trade it for anything.
Right.
So how did you get into hardcore then? You said 83.
Yeah. Do you want the sort of long-winded version or the abridged version?
Give us the full version. Why not?
Okay. I am the youngest of five, so my childhood was spent mostly riding around in the backseat of my mom's Chevy Vega as we were taking my siblings to various events.
Right.
And my mom had a fondness for soft rock.
Hmm.
She listened to WMGK in Philadelphia, which now... The playlist, I imagine there would be a whole lot of overlap with the bridge from SiriusXM.
Okay.
So that was sort of all those maudlin pop songs of the 70s were my favorites. And then my mom got an 8-track in her car. And so then she started rocking like Sgt. Pepper and various Beatles things. So those I really liked. And then I was sort of getting into Billy Joel when I switched schools in fifth grade. And my my friend Dave had this older brother, Phil, whose room looked like Mike Damone's in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. There were like posters everywhere. And he was like, what kind of music do you like? And I was like, Billy Joel and maybe the Beatles. And he was like, no. So he turned me on to, sort of the Doors, but also he was into like Elvis Costello and the Clash. But he was like, the Clash are great. The Clash are new wave. Mm. Just don't listen to punk because that stuff's terrible. And so, you know, I became obsessed first with the Doors. Then I sort of moved into Adam and the Ants and sort of more new wavy type stuff. But, you know, it seemed I looked around me and I went to sort of a dull private school. And, you know, a lot of people kind of like that stuff. But then there were like these four kids that were older than I was that were into punk rock. Mm. And like, that's what I wanted. And when I say punk rock, I'm not talking like the Sex Pistols, though they may have liked that. They liked like Black Flag and like hardcore.
Right.
But like you couldn't really hear that, or at least I didn't know how to go about hearing that because there were no computers and you know, commercial radio certainly didn't play it. So the only way that you could discover or hear hardcore punk was either through a friend of yours or do what I did, which is on a fateful day in March of 1983, I wandered into the listening booth at the Willow Grove Mall in suburban Philadelphia, sort of combed the racks, and I settled upon this record, The Best of Rodney on the Rock, Volume 1. And I looked at the back, and it was like Black Flag, Circle Jerks, Agent Orange, all the bands that like the four punk rockers at my school had written on their like jackets. And so I was like, all right, I'll go with that one. And, you know, as luck would have it, I picked out what is, you know, widely regarded as the objectively finest hardcore punk compilation of all time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So does that lead us into our first song, Will?
I think it does. All right. Why don't we do that?
Agent Orange.
Yeah, that is Agent Orange from Placentia, California, which is in Orange County. And, you know, one of the things that I really love about that song, well, there are many things I really love about it, but one of the coolest things I think is, you know, it's a hardcore punk song, and hardcore punk was sort of regarded as being so much different than everything else and sort of setting out to destroy what had come before. But really, you listen to that guitar solo, that is like straight Dick Dale. It's you got this sort of California sound of the past that they're mixing in with the present.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah. Very cool. Talk a little bit, Hunter, just for a minute or two about, you know, you mentioned it kind of in your intro. There were guys that, hey, yeah, they might have liked the Sex Pistols, but this is the punk that they were really listening to. So kind of the differentiation between that, I guess, what we'll call first wave of punk and then sort of hardcore that started, I don't know, 79, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if you listen to Nevermind the Bollocks, the Sex Pistols record, or, you know, even, you know, the Clash's first record and certainly their latter records, those things, I mean, Nevermind the Bollocks is a fantastic sounding record,
yeah.
but it really doesn't sound all that different than sort of hard rock of the 70s. Mm-hmm. You know, hardcore was different in that the songs were like a minute long yeah. and they really cut out everything except just the bare essentials. And a lot of times, I mean, these records were recorded on a shoestring budget.
Yeah.
So they are sonically imperfect, let's say, but still there's something about them. Like you listen to that Agent Orange record. And as soon as the first note hit, I was like, man, I am in a whole different territory.
Right.
It's got that relentless. And you know, it was like a volt of electricity rushing through my body when I heard it.
And it's hard, I think, going back now after being through the thrash metal and speed metal and yeah. some of these eras, that to say how fast that music sounded then, but it did sound
right.
very, 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 very fast. I mean, it sounded way faster than anything you had ever heard before, at least to me in that era.
Yeah, yeah. And now, like listening back, it's really melodic.
Yeah, exactly.
In a way that like you said, like, you know, everything that's come after, like, you know, grindcore or anything like that, really isn't. So it's really,
yeah.
you know, I thought that this was a huge leap for me into the unknown at the time, but really it kind of sounds a lot like everything else that I like. You know, it sounds a lot like Billy Joel, just faster and less well produced.
I think that what these kids were doing in Southern California was really, I think, the start of punk rock in America.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you think of the Sex Pistols, the Clash, and then the Ramones in New York were all on major labels.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
They were all part of what I think the record companies hoped would be like a new movement that they could market and sell, yeah. you know? Mm-hmm. And then the New York bands, the CBGB bands and all that kind of stuff were still, you know, maybe they were still kind of underground being in the Bowery and all that, but they were still in New York and it was a major media center and they had a lot of buzz that was happening, right?
Right.
Whether or not, you know, middle America got into it,
mm-hmm.
really didn't matter, you know, because it sold on the East Coast, you know,
right.
To those people. So to me, when people talk about punk being DIY, like this is it.
Yes.
These are people yeah. who are doing it just to do it, you know, without anybody really of any import behind them.
Yep.
Yeah. And you also make a great point in that these actually were kids.
Yeah.
I mean, Agent yeah. Orange were teenagers,
yes.
as were most of the bands on this compilation. And now I should mention this came out on Posh Boy Records in
yes.
1981.
Yeah.
And Posh Boy was a guy, his real name was Robbie Fields. He's still alive, but he called himself Robbie Posh Boy because he had purportedly been educated in one of those fancy English public schools like Eton or Harrow
right.
or something. So somehow he ends up in Los Angeles working as a bus boy in a restaurant. Something obviously went terribly wrong in his posh upbringing that he ended up as a bus boy. But he would go to Orange County and he would check out these bands like Agent Orange and the Adolescents, who we're about to hear, and he would sign them. He would have them sign actual contracts. He would take them into the studio. He would be either the real producer or the executive producer, and he'd have them knock out a couple songs and he would release them. And that's what comprises the Rodney on the Rock Volume
yeah.
1. And Rodney is Rodney Bingenheimer, the famed LA DJ
yeah.
who had a radio station on K-Rock on which he, unlike most mainstream radio DJs, would actually play hardcore by bands like
yeah.
Agent Orange
yeah.
and the Adolescents. And so this is just kind of, you know, Posh Boy, apparently, to hear the bands tell it, ripped them all off and had them sign incredibly unfair contracts. But at the same time, like, he was getting them in the studio
yeah.
and he documented this and sounds great.
Yeah, and got them on the radio. So it's
yeah.
an amazing
and
thing, too.
If you look at Posh Boy's releases just in 1981, it's pretty much an incredible roster of California hardcore.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing about Orange County I think is important, too, was you're talking about, this term may get overused, but I think it's true here, is it's kind of disaffected youth, right?
Yeah.
The idea that they were like, they weren't in LA. I mean, I know some of the bands we're going to talk about were, but a lot of them were Orange County. They were separated from the city and in, you know, total suburbia, right?
Yeah.
And what else, you know, it's sort of like, what else can we do but just like get bands together and play in somebody's garage.
That's right.
And
yeah.
just, you know, be angry at the world, right? Because we're, you know, we're living in this like sort of Reagan youth, you know,
well, that's the
area, right?
Yeah.
You know, Orange County was super conservative
yeah.
at that time. And this also corresponded with the rise of sort of skater culture too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of the Orange County kids felt like they were unfairly blamed by the... There was the sort of Hollywood punk scene, which was the Germs and X and those right. bands. And that all centered around the mask. And it was really sort of an arty scene. And it was not at all sort of like violent or aggressive, or at least compared to what came after, it wasn't. And the Orange County kids, you know, whether fairly or unfairly, got blamed for coming to the shows, making them much less of sort of an arty supportive thing and turning it into like a sort of madhouse of like slam dancing.
Yeah, right.
And so I think that just upped the resentment even more that they were getting blamed by these people in their 20s and 30s for ruining their punk rock scene.
Yeah, exactly.
This Agent Orange record, I had this in the 80s and... or at least a version of it. I think an extended version that came out later
yeah,
that
had a lot of the surf stuff on it. Living in Darkness, which was the sort of full-length Posh Boy. And then they put out a really cool EP called Bitchin' Summer where they did Miserlou by Dick Dale and Pipeline. Right. And
so I remember all those. And in fact, when I, in 1985, when I was a freshman in college and was in the, you know, the dorm, and there was a kid right across the hall who was really into like, you know, hardcore stuff. And so Agent Orange was, I think it was like one of the first ones, if maybe not the first one he introduced to me, because it was sort of like, I think you could handle this. Like, this is a good starting point, right? Because
it's gateway hardcore.
That's right. Yeah, it was. There you go. It was because, you know, it's melodic and it doesn't sound like so hard. You know what I mean? And the songs, I think, are like really well structured. I mean, these could be Ramon songs, right? They're yeah. just they're verse, chorus, verse with like good melodies. Oh, yeah. And, yeah.
And one of the things I think is so cool is, again, you've got the relentless da-na-na-na-na-na-na on the verse. And then in the chorus, it opens up. But right in the middle of the chorus, it goes right back to the da-na-na-na-na-na-na. Yeah. They reprise the verse to like just great effect.
I have a soft spot for Agent Orange. I think they're really cool.
Yeah, me too. I like them.
All right, so two thumbs up for Agent Orange. Three thumbs up for Agent Orange.
I will tell you really quickly, one of our favorite things to do back in the early days of my band when we would play was come on stage and say, very much anti-Ian MacKay of you know, Fugazi would come on and say, hi, we're Fugazi from Washington, D.C. We would come on and say, hi, we're Agent Orange. And then we would start playing and would occasionally get a laugh. Yeah. And most people were saying, like, who the hell are these guys? Are they done yet?
All right. So one more sort of note for you train spotters. The bass player on that first track by Agent Orange was a guy named Steve Soto, who also played bass in this next band we're going to hear, The Adolescents. So let's listen to this next song, Amoeba by The Adolescents, which is, you know, dare I say it, probably the greatest song ever written about killer amoeba or amoebas or amoebae.
They never lie. How can this fall my code? I've never seen anything like it before. This amoeba's got a mind of its own. But don't turn your back to stupid science world. This is reaching for the telephone.
All right, so that was Amoeba by The Adolescents, who were also from Orange County, California. They were from Fullerton, which I think Kevin Costner was either from there or played baseball for Cal State Fullerton. But anyway, again, like, you know, as I said with Agent Orange, again, here are The Adolescents to destroy all the music that you liked before. But I mean, what's leaping out at you? But the harmonies that could be off a Beach Boys record.
Right.
And then... The Adolescents guitar player, the Adolescents singer and bass player, Tony Brandenburg and Steve Soto, they were teenagers. Rick Agnew was a little bit older. He was probably in his early 20s, but he is a hardcore punk guitar hero. He pioneered the use of the octave guitar mm-hmm. leads there, which, you know, Brian Baker then sort of took to the next level.
Right.
But it's, I mean, everything about that is so melodic and it's so great. And they have just boiled it down to the very essence of what makes a great song.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well said. And I'll tell you, this album, you know, before the other group's Blue album, this was one of the best-selling hardcore albums. You know, it was everywhere. I remember seeing that for many years, and that's one. If you want to get a hardcore record from the you know, origins of hardcore, this is a great one to get. That first one, just that's Blue with the red Adolescence writing on the front. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that would definitely be in my top five hardcore yep. records, if not number one. Mm-hmm. And that has a song on it called Kids of the Black Hole that is like a magnum opus. It's, I think, 4 minutes long, which for a hardcore song in like hardcore minutes, that's like 25 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's about Mike Ness from Social Distortion's like crash pad apartment where they all hung out in Fullerton until Mike Ness got evicted. And the guitar playing on that is so insanely intricate and great. Like you can't believe it. Like all of you out there in listener land, do me a favor. As soon as you finish listening to today's broadcast, go onto YouTube and listen to Kids of the Black Hole. You won't regret it.
Yep.
Very cool.
Okay. So next up, we are going to go in a slightly older and more Los Angeles-y direction. We are going to play Wild in the Streets by the Circle Jerks, who were from the South Bay area of LA, which is, in fact, in LA County. They were from Hermosa Beach. So let's let them take it away.
Wild in the Streets!
All right, so that was the Circle Jerks. The Circle Jerks were a little bit older than Agent Orange and the Adolescents. They were all guys in their 20s. In fact, Lucky Lehrer, the drummer, was a law student at the time he was playing in the Circle Jerks. That is actually a cover of a Garland Jeffries song.
It is.
And it sounds nothing like the Garland Jeffries song. And the Garland Jeffries song is great.
Yeah.
But it is like... how they decided to do that to that song, I don't know. It was, if I had to guess, I'd say it was probably Keith Morris, who is a real sort of student of rock and
roll
and has great taste. But I mean, not only did they completely change the feel of the song, they also changed the lyrics. The second verse, the I got a 64 Valiant and a handful of Valiums, a couple of beers really do me right. Better believe us, you better trust us, teenage jive fucking wreck. Like, if I had to guess, that was probably written by Roger Rogerson, the bass player who drove a 64 Valiant and apparently would have fistfuls of Valiums.
Just keep them on an even keel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that may be a little bit more sort of immediate and aggressive than even Agent Orange and the Adolescents. But again, it's got just tons of melody.
Yeah. And the Circle Jerks were led by Keith Morris, who originally was with Black Flag. And
yes.
It was kind of his second band that he formed.
Yeah. And you know, another cool thing about this, the Circle Jerks second record is called Wild in the Streets.
Yeah.
And they redid a version of this. And it's less good than this Posh Boy version.
Yeah.
And Posh Boy, again, with his contracts, he locked up the rights in perpetuity to this version of the song. And it's good that he did, because it's a little bit better than the subsequent version.
Yeah. And you know, the Circle Jerks too, I'll say this, I don't know if you ever got to see them, Jim, but
no.
They stayed together till 89. So I was actually able to see them, you know, like, wow, this is a real authentic first wave, you know, hardcore band that, I obviously don't think all the original members were in the band at that time, but it was very exciting and cool to actually be able to see them, you know, in their sort of first incarnation.
Yeah.
Because I think they lasted till 89 or 90 in that first
in the first wave. And then they got back together in the 90s.
Yep.
But they, what was cool about the Circle Jerks was they left hardcore behind after probably the third record, Golden Shower of Hits. Yep. After that, they kind of went in a hard rock direction, but none of their records were bad.
Yeah,
they exactly. were like, even as a hard rock band, they were really good and mm-hmm. cool and had something to say.
Mm-hmm.
I also think all of this sounds like California in a way. I mean, you kind of referenced a little bit, but it all sounds like stuff you would listen to with the top down or the windows rolled down, you know, nice day and just sort of blaring it out of your car speakers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I always think it's really like, I don't think you could separate this stuff from Southern California. Mm. It's, I mean, it is, it's like you said, like it's just, I listen to it and it evokes Southern California. Yeah. I imagine myself driving down like some endless highway with like palm trees in the distance.
Yeah.
All right. So, as Patrick mentioned, Keith Morris, the singer of the Circle Jerks, was the original vocalist in Black Flag. Mm-hmm. This next song is by Black Flag, though it does not feature Keith. It features the guy who replaced him, Ron Reyes. And so, this next song is called No Values.
I don't care what you think.
That, I think, was probably the shoutiest of the songs that we played. But even then, you can hear him. He's singing.
Yeah, without a doubt.
There's a melody there for sure.
Yep.
Yeah.
Everything on that recording is kind of pushed to the red. And it, I think, again, it totally works. Like, I remember when I heard that for the first time when I was a kid, I was like, that is noticeably angrier than the other songs on here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's got sort of an undeniable appeal at the same time. Maybe that is the appeal.
Yeah, absolutely.
The as we were talking about before, Black Flag actually in the first run had four singers. There was Keith Morris to start. Then there was Ron Reyes, Ron Reyes had a falling out with the band between the time that he had recorded the tracks for the Jealous Again EP and when it came out. And they got mad at him, so they changed his name on the EP to Chavo Pederast. And so he was replaced by Dez Cadena, who was a great singer, but Dez Cadena, his voice would blow out after a couple of shows. So he moved to second guitar and was replaced by Washington, D.C.'s own Henry Garfield, who is better known as Henry Rollins.
That's right, from State of Alert. And that, you know, was a key moment, I think, for Black Flag because it totally pushed them in a direction that later they would explore, you know, with a much more turgid, sort of a heavier sound and all those things. But it was a key development for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I it's funny today in the car, as I was sort of thinking of this coming up, I finally resigned myself to the fact or admitted to myself that no matter how many times I listen to them, I'm never going to understand or like those Black Flag records that came out after my war. But
well,
I tried for 30 years. Yeah. You know, I've done all I can do.
It's enough to respect them. I don't know if you generally have to like them, right?
Yeah.
And I do think, obviously, you know, we could do a whole week on Black Flag, but just to say how important they were in establishing a cross-country circuit for bands to play, they were really the trailblazers and going and finding places to play and continuing to go back to those places. And when you read about a lot of these bands that we'll talk about later in the week, you always hear this thing like, well, nobody ever came to our town except for Black Flag. Like they came once and that changed, you know, there was 10 guys, you know, like kind of were saying those four guys that I knew, they all got it and they were all at the show, but Black Flag came there and that sparked a whole scene in that town, wherever that might be.
Yeah. And it's, if, you know, if you want to read a little more on the subject, if you read a book called Get in the Van by Henry Rollins, which is his tour diary from the Black Flag tours, you get a sense of, not only how long they were on the road, but how miserable it was at the same time.
Yeah, you feel exhausted after reading that book. You feel like you were with them. It's really kind of discouraging at times. Yeah. Let's sit in the big boy and wait till the family leaves and then grab the food they left on the table so we get something to eat. Yeah.
Oh, and before I forget, I meant to say this earlier in the show, but the four guys at my school that had the hardcore bands written on the back of their jackets, they actually had a band called Better Living.
Wow.
And Better Living opened for the Circle Jerks.
Did they really?
And that was the first concert I ever attended in my life.
Oh, wow.
The Circle Jerks on November 20th, 1983 at Love Hall, which is, it was the corner of Broad and South Streets in Philadelphia. And it is last time I drove by there, it was a empty lot.
Oh, wow.
So.
At least it wasn't a Starbucks.
Yes.
You know, but that's such a great point because Black Flag would come through and if there wasn't a band in that town, they would play or they had a band with them. But the next time they came back, there often was a local band that would be third on that bill or fourth on that bill. And they would always get a chance to play, which is pretty important.
Yeah. Yeah. They were truly trailblazers. Yeah. So another interesting thing about this compilation is that side one was the hardcore side and side two was sort of the poppier, like, let's take some chances side. So we are going to play one track off of there, which is by a band called The Crowd, who are from Huntington Beach.
Okay.
And, you know, what's interesting is this was The Crowd's move away from hardcore and into playing power pop or sort of like poppy punk. But, you know, you listen to The Crowd's other songs and they were kind of poppy too. So I'm not sure it was as big a departure as it was sort of made out to be on this record. But, and in fact, The Crowd were sort of the original Huntington Beach tough guys. The singer, Jim Trash, purportedly invented slam dancing, which was called the Huntington Beach Shuffle.
Yeah.
And apparently, if you went down to Huntington Beach and went to a Crowd show, everybody would be wearing Dayglow and doing the Huntington Beach Shuffle.
Wow.
But this next song is remarkably good. So I will stop talking about it and let it speak for itself.
Great tune. Yeah. Really, really is good. But the hand claps, man, can't beat it.
Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It gives it kind of a power pop feel to it, right?
For sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. People, I guess because of the bands that I've played in, assume that I love power pop, but really, I don't really care for it. Like, you know, because I always think of, you know, like the Raspberries or stuff that's really like really overproduced.
Yeah.
That's the kind of power pop I love.
Right.
Like that Crowd song, like that to me is perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, an amazing song. And I love what you had in your notes, Hunter, too, that the Huntington Beach kids came and scared all the LA punks into retirement, or at least roots rock or new wave. That was a great line. Especially roots rock. I'm real scared. I'm joining the Blasters.
All right, cool. So this is the introduction, right, to hardcore for the week.
And I don't know that this Rodney on the Rock compilation is available on the streamings, is it? It may be something you have to track down or put together off of other sources.
It is available on the YouTube.
Oh, yeah. That's what you need to do, folks. Go and put that together.
Somebody put that up there.
Yeah. It's a good thing. And there's also a volume 2, which is interesting. Definitely different, but came out on Posh Boy as well.
Yeah, there's a volume 2 and there's even a volume 3.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There is a precipitous drop in quality between volumes 2 and 3.
Okay.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Posh Boy is, again, he got a lot of bands in the studio and recorded them, and then it seems to have sort of seems a little like maybe nobody would have worked with him after about 1982. Yeah. But he has this incredible catalog of songs. And so what he'll do is, like, he will reprint a compilation, but he'll swap out and put in, like, new tracks. He had a song called The Future Looks Bright Ahead. Or a compilation called The Future Looks Brighter or something like that. And he would just, you know, every couple of years he'd repress it and he'd swap out, like, okay, this time we're going to have some Red Cross songs. Now we're going to put this in there.
Right.
So, yeah.
Keeping himself in business.
Is this Rodney on the Rock compilation in the Patrick Foster collection? Is it available there?
As a matter of fact, okay. Yes, it is. I do have a copy of it, so I'm happy about that.
All right.
Yep.
I'll have to see that next time I'm in the basement.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So tomorrow, well, all this week, we're going to be talking more about hardcore, and that means we have to crash at your place tonight,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. If you look over your shoulder, Jim, you'll see that there is a nice, comfortable double bed there for you and Patrick.
That's right.
And if you're really lucky, my dog Hugo will come down and stay serve between as us. A blanket.
There you go. All right. All right, let's move on to tomorrow.
It's a three-dog night if it gets cold.
It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us is...
Hunter Bennett.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was in high school, we had this room, the senior room, and I would always try and play what I liked, and I would always get voted down by the people that wanted to hear Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
And and so, like, a couple of years later, this would have been like 92 or 93, post Nirvana's Nevermind, a guy that was always leading the Pink Floyd charge said to me, "So how's it feel?" And I was like, "What?" And he goes, "You were totally right."
Oh, really? That's so funny.
Yeah, great.